Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. A new civil rights group in town calls itself Black Rainbow, and it's pushing to see big budget cuts to the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. We'll talk to one of its founders in just a moment. Later, term limits and ethics in government are just two of the issues on the November ballot in Missouri. We'll give you a preview. And finally today, KCUR music contributor Bill Brownlee on his new love of opera. We start, though, with KCUR Sam Zeff with what's happening here in the news. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's start with the latest on the pandemic.
Yep, Kansas City Health Department cutting back on services this morning after two workers in the office tested positive for COVID-19. Nine others have been quarantined. Now, the department said in its statement that the two workers who were exposed to the virus outside of the health department. Here's what's important to know. The department says it will be taking far fewer appointments at its immunization and sexual health clinics over the next 14 days. Also, testing rates for COVID-19 in Missouri have been decreasing in recent weeks. And as KCUR's Alex Smith discovered, that makes it hard to know what's actually happening with the spread of the virus.
Missouri is among a minority of states that appear to have seen decreases in new cases since mid-September, but decreases in testing could explain the trend. The state health department reports an average of just under 15,000 tests per day compared to nearly 18,000 in mid-September. Testing rates are far higher in cities than in rural parts of the state, although the positivity rate for the Kansas City area stands at 15.7%, the highest rate since April. The state's positivity rating for the last 2 weeks is 17.1%, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. For KCUR 89.3, I'm Alex Smith.
Also, Steve, Missouri Governor Mike Parson says four of his staff members have tested positive for COVID-19. He released that information yesterday after first refusing to do so. Governor's office also says Parson and his wife have returned to their normal schedules after both were quarantined with the virus. There was a piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday that had 1,800 total Missouri state workers testing positive for COVID-19, 650 in the Department of Corrections. That's the hardest hit department. Also, 211 in the Department of Public Safety. Now, that's a department that includes the Missouri State Highway Patrol, National Guard, casino enforcement, and more. You'll remember that last week we confirmed three COVID-19 cases at Troop A out in Lee's Summit. The patrol wouldn't comment except to say they don't reveal how many troopers have tested positive.
Let's turn to politics here this morning, Sam.
Lots of political news, kind of the choke the horse part of the campaign here. New poll shows President Trump with a rather narrow lead over Joe Biden in Missouri. This is the Remington Research poll. That's a poll that leans Republican, but it shows Trump with a 51-46 lead over Biden. The poll also has Governor Parson up 51-44 over Democrat Nicole Galloway in the gubernatorial race. I should say that there are a smattering of other polls out there that have that close racer, closer. And finally, Politico reports this morning that a Democratic super PAC will spend $7.5 million on the Senate race in Kansas. Steve, this is a clear sign that Democrats believe Barbara Boyer can beat Roger Marshall for this open seat. Last week, that super PAC controlled by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said it was investing $7.2 million in the Marshall campaign, $15 million in outside money coming into that Kansas Senate race.
Clearly, a very competitive race. That's KCUR Sam Zeff. Sam, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Black Rainbow is the name of a new civil rights organization in Kansas City. They've organized out of the recent protests following the death of George Floyd. They've since gone on to make their message known and to continue to protest against racial inequity. Among their demands, big cuts in the police department with the money going to social programs and the firing of Police Chief Rick Smith. Joining me now is Ryan Sorrell. He's co-founder of Black Rainbow. He joins us from outside of City Hall. Ryan, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on here today.
You know, I understand you are downtown now for the Occupy KC protests. These are the protests outside of City Hall and police headquarters where protesters have set up tents and they're camped out, demanding that Police Chief Rick Smith resign and also calling for justice for a young woman who was 9 months pregnant who was recently arrested by police. In the course of that arrest, an officer is seen in a video kneeling on the back of the pregnant woman with her belly on the ground. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing around you this morning, Ryan, outside of City Hall there.
Sure. I mean, we're all here for one reason, and we're keeping that central reason on Deja, who is the 25-year-old pregnant Black woman who is two weeks from being due to give birth to her baby. She was, you know, recording an encounter with the police, and a police officer actually threw her onto the ground. And so a 9 months pregnant Black woman, they threw her onto the ground. They put their knee into her back. She was hospitalized twice following the, gross, excessive use of force against this woman. And we've only been able to talk to her once while we've been physically out here. But I'm really excited because this is the first time that Kansas City has seen anything of this capacity in over a decade. And so, the resolve of the people that are out here is relentless. And I'm incredibly excited to see the mass movement that's on the ground here today.
Ryan, how is she doing today? Any idea?
Specifically today, I'm not exactly sure. She did come out here 2 days ago just to, you know, say hi to the people. She had an incredibly difficult time getting out of the car. She couldn't even speak at the press conference. She could only speak in whispers. And she's in, an extreme amount of pain right now still, and her baby is still fighting for its life.
Tell us what this sit-in is protesting, Ryan, what it's all about, and how has it gone so far?
Sure, yeah. So we have three very clear demands that we want to see before we go anywhere. We don't plan on going anywhere until these demands are met. Our very first demand is we want Police Chief Rick Smith, racist Police Chief Rick Smith, fired. He's, had numerous attempts and numerous opportunities to improve our relationships with the Black community, and we don't see that happening. All we see is, after Cameron Lamb was murdered, he allowed for the police officer to go back onto the streets just 9 days later. There is absolutely no other occupation in the United States of America where a person can kill someone else and be back onto the streets 9 days later. So those are the types of, abuses of power that we're seeing coming from the Kansas City Police Department. So we're calling for Police Chief Rick Smith to be fired. We're also calling for Officer Newton to be fired. Officer Newton is the one who aggressively assaulted Deja. We're calling for him to be fired without pay. And lastly, we're calling for a 50% divestment and reallocation to invest into the Black community. We think that the Black community has been systematically divested from institutions like our education, our schools, our healthcare programs, our mental health programs, housing. These have been divested from. So we want to see a reinvestment of that 50% away from the KCPD back into those essential resources for our community.
But what do you say when even the mayor seems to acknowledge that the police chief is not going to be fired, at least in the short term, that cuts of 50% to the police department are wholly unrealistic, Ryan? What do you say to that?
What I say is unrealistic is the current state of the Kansas City and what Black people have to go through here in Kansas City. I mean, it's absolutely unthinkable. The fact that we spend $273 million on the Kansas City Police Department, for every $1,000 that we spend on the Kansas City Police Department, only $1 goes to mental health. Only $1 goes to mental health programs in this city. And so to me, that's unthinkable. That's unfathomable. And so, we're an abolitionist organization, and we talk about there being presence. A lot of times when people hear the word abolition, they think of an absence. They think of an absence of police, or they think of an absence of prisons. But really what we're talking about is a presence. We're talking about the presence of life-affirming institutions, of people having the essential resources that they need to survive. And so to me, that's a much more realistic, a much more humane world that I think that is possible for us to live in if we divest away from the Kansas City Police Department. And that's Mayor Lucas's job to determine whether it's realistic or not. We are the ones just bringing the vision to life.
Ryan, do you have any allies on the city council who are willing to stand up and say, yes, you're right, we're going to cut spending on the police by 50% over the next few years?
That's something that we're still working on. We have talked to multiple council members, and there are numerous council members that are in support of our occupation. I'm not exactly sure how many of them are on board with the 50% reallocation, but they do support what we're doing right now. And one of our demands right now is the 50% divestment from KCPD. So specifically, we're still in talks with a number of council members, but generally, I think that there's definitely a consensus amongst, Eric Bunch, Councilwoman Shaw. There are other council members as well. Councilwoman Robinson, who have, publicly said that the amount of money that we're spending on the Kansas City Police Department right now is absolutely unnecessary. And in fact, it's draining. For every dollar that we spend on the Kansas City Police Department, it's actually draining money from essential resources that we need in our community. It's actively draining money, and it's hurting our communities and hurting people who can't pay for their housing and that are getting evicted. It's draining money from those people.
Right.
So that's kind of where we're standing right now.
I'm visiting with Ryan Sorrell. He's co-founder of Black Rainbow. It's a new civil rights organization in Kansas City. Members now camped out in front of City Hall. They've been there for several days. Can you tell us a little more about how Black Rainbow was founded, Ryan?
Sure. So it's actually a very interesting story, I think. We originally began as a music collective, as an artistic collective. We weren't very political at all. We knew that politics was a potential of something that we could step into. But originally, we were just a rap group. And then after George Floyd was brutally murdered on May 25th, we saw the need for direct actions and for mobilization on the ground here in Kansas City. There was an energy. There were an enormous amount of people, thousands of people in the plaza that wanted to see some type of justice. And so we did what we could to step into that space and help organize mobilizing direct actions. And so that was really the beginning of it, was direct actions, mobilizing on the ground. Since then, we've grown enormously, both in our political thought, but also in the physical support that we have from people on the ground. So we've done things from grocery buyouts, where we'll go to a grocery store and stand at the grocery line at the cash register and just pay for people's groceries for an hour or two. We've also done community cleanups, where we just go to a recreation center that has lots of trash around it, and we'll just clean things up. And then lastly, we also do political educations, and that's one of the most important aspects and tenets of our organization is political education, where we educate people inside of our group on things like anti-racism, on things like patriarchy, on things like misogyny, on things like what is capitalism and how does it affect the Black community and what are our relationships with
right.
it? What is racialized capitalism? So lots of different areas that we go into in political education, but I think the three core tenets are direct action, political education, and community engagement.
So what makes Black Rainbow different from other civil rights groups around town?
Sure. So we are actually, I wouldn't consider ourselves a civil rights group. I would consider us a collective. When I think of civil rights groups, I think more of, the NAACP, the SCLC, the Urban League, which are incredibly important and have historically been significant in the Black Power movement and Black progress, even here in Kansas City. But oftentimes they're not mobilizing as much on the ground in terms of doing direct actions and getting arrested and things like that, which is a position and a role that we need for them to play because they do very important work in terms of policy. So for us, our role is to put pressure onto the politicians right here on the ground. We'll put our bodies on the line. We've had numerous people be arrested continually. Our members are being followed home by police officers. They're being surveilled. We have to use, encrypted messaging systems. And people have seen police officers frequent their houses much more usually and regularly than ever happened before they were involved in political activity. So, I think that our niche, I guess you could call it, is that we really do direct actions and mobilize on the ground in a very radical way, but in a way that's still uplifting and safe and nonviolent and peaceful for the community.
Ryan, do you have documentation of that police surveilling some of your members? Because if that's the case, that would be of great concern to a lot of people in town.
Absolutely. I'm not sure mostly it has been testimonies from people. I know that Stacey Shaw, who is a very well-known activist out here in Kansas City, she has stated publicly and multiple times that she has seen police officers roaming around her law office. She has seen more police officers around her house. They were investigating her for things that she didn't do. So I'm not sure how we would get that type of thing documented, but there are definitely numerous people within our organization who have, you know, given testimonies that this has been happening to them.
Your open letter to Mayor Lucas, in which you objected to federal agents coming to town under Operation Legend. This was the federal operation aimed at sort of stemming the violence in Kansas City that was championed by President Trump. That open letter was co-signed by the Urban League of Kansas City as well as the NAACP. What did that mean for your organization?
I mean, it was an incredibly historic moment, a momentous moment for the city of Kansas City, specifically for the Black liberation movement here in Kansas City. Never before, at least in my lifetime, has there ever been a coalition of organizations that we saw on that open letter calling out Mayor Lucas for his duplicity, for his complicity in the subjugation of Black people and the continual willingness to do things like accept money from the Fraternal Order of Police when we're calling for divesting away from the police. And so the reason that it was such a historical moment in our city and for the Black liberation movement is because we saw these legacy organizations that typically have to take a more moderate position, really stepping and taking a much more progressive position in aligning themselves with the demands that we had. And our demands included that 50% divestment that we think is critical, absolutely critical to see any type of reduction in crime, an increase in the way that people are able to live. I mean, we want people to be able to live with dignity. We don't want them to live under state sanctioned terrorism of the Kansas City Police Department. For us to have all those different organizations on paper, KC Tenants, the Sunrise Movement, it was just an incredibly right. historic day for our city and for our movement. So I was very, very excited to see that be able to happen.
You know, give me a sense of what a middle ground might look like here, because again, it seems to me that politically speaking, a 50% cut in the police department at a time when homicides are at all-time high rates is simply politically unfeasible. You're not going to get there. So what's the middle ground look like?
I think this is the middle ground. I think it is the middle ground. I think we have to talk about, and from a philosophical, socio-political perspective, think about what it is that the police actually do. And the police don't prevent crime. The police react to crime. And we think that there are much better ways that we could react to crime. Even in our own people's city here, where we're occupying at City Hall, where we're demonstrating what it looks like to have a community of people without police, we've had arguments arise here. But the arguments were not resolved by someone being shot and killed. The arguments were resolved by people who know how to do crisis intervention. And so the police do not keep people safe. And specifically for Black people, the police have never even been created to keep Black people safe. And so in the last 8 years, what we've actually seen is a 24% increase in the police budget and a nearly 48% increase in the amount of crime that's taking place in Kansas City. So there's absolutely no correlation to increasing the police budget. There's no correlation with that decreasing the actual crime. So really statistically and historically and politically, to me, the most ideal option and the most, option that makes sense, pragmatic option, is for us to invest in life-affirming institutions, things that actually have been proven to decrease crime, things like education. If you have a proper educational, retainment level, right, then you're less likely to, commit crime. So that's really where our middle ground is. Our ultimate that we would like to see is the actual abolition of police. And I know that can sound like a radical idea for a lot of people who haven't studied this and who aren't used to these ideas. But if you really look into the creation of the police department and its relationships with the Black community, I think it's very clear that that's the only solution for us to stop undergoing this type of terrorism against our communities.
Ryan, just wrapping up here, as you look around you this morning at City Hall, how many fellow members are with you from Black Rainbow? How big is your crowd this morning?
I would say roughly 6 to 8 people from our group right now, but we have people, you know, generally I would say throughout the day, maybe around 15 people, just because people have to go for school. Some people are still in college. Some people are in art school. Some people have work to go to. Some people have kids to take care of. So I would say between 8 and 15 people.
That's Ryan Sorrell. He's co-founder of Black Rainbow. Its members now encamped outside of City Hall in downtown Kansas City. Ryan, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Coming up after a short break, a look at two high-interest proposed constitutional amendments on the Missouri ballot next month. One deals with term limits, the other with ethics. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Missouri voters face two big issues on the November ballot next month. One has to do with term limits, the other with ethics and government. Amendment 1 is the term limits proposal aimed at addressing a quirk in Missouri government. The governor and state treasurer can now serve no more than 2 terms. This amendment would extend that 2-term limit to the lieutenant governor, secretary of state, auditor, and attorney general. Amendment 3 has to do with the Clean Missouri proposal that voters adopted in 2018. Republicans want another vote on the issue this year, and it would change the redistricting process that Clean Missouri envisioned. Here to talk about these proposals are Aviva Okeson-Haberman. She's KCUR's Missouri government and politics reporter. Aviva, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Robin Kuhlman's also with us. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Central Missouri. Robin, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Robin, how tough is it to get voters interested in these constitutional amendments, which, you know, typically they're at the bottom of the ballot, especially during a big presidential election year like this one is?
And that's a great question. Typically speaking, you know, it just depends on the ballot measure. You know, we have some ballot measures that include, you know, legalizing marijuana, hot button issues like about things like abortion. It just really depends. This particular ballot measure, we talk about term limits or we talk about something like, you know, Amendment 3. These have gained some steam to a certain extent, not necessarily Amendment 1, but Amendment 3 has, I think, garnered enough information for voters, at least for in 2018, that it essentially allowed them to, you know, think about the amendment process and go for it. If I just want to kind of point out, if we look at roll off in 2018 and 2016 from the top of the ticket races to those ballot measures, it's only about 3.5%. So I wouldn't necessarily think that it's all that difficult for voters to think about these measures and then vote on them.
You're saying that 3.5% of voters in 2018, they voted on the first races on the ballot, but then didn't vote on the things that showed up at the bottom of the ballot.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you think about that, that's fairly minimal considering both a midterm election and also a presidential election.
Right.
Of course, we have different voters in midterm elections than we do in presidential elections. Presidential elections, we have a lot of, you know, the general voters that turn out for those top of the ticket races. But yet we still, at least in the state of Missouri, from what I've seen, see voters still interested in voting on those ballot measures.
Aviva, give us some context here. How important are these two ballot issues that Missourians will confront next month? How big a deal are these? What kind of impact would they have?
So they might sound a bit wonky, but they are really important. I mean, term limits determine how long a politician can stay in office, right? And Amendment 3 makes changes in how districts are drawn, which can affect who represents you in office. Lots of important things happen on the state level, changes of education funding, gun laws, abortion access. So these are two important issues.
Well, let's begin with the statewide office term limits amendment, because I think that's maybe a little easier to grasp. Aviva, what does this amendment do?
So it limits the lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, and state auditor to two terms in office. Right now, that applies to the governor and state treasurer. And so that would just extend the term limits to the other statewide offices.
Who's pushing for it?
So it's put on the ballot by the Missouri legislature, and actually a local Republican state senator proposed it, Tony Luchtemeyer from Parkville.
Robin, have we seen cases of lieutenant governors or secretaries of state staying in office beyond two terms?
I haven't seen, looking back at the length of terms for lieutenant governor and secretary of state. But the most recent statewide executive was Attorney General Jay Nixon, who served from 1993 effectively into a part of 2009. And then, of course, we have State Auditor Margaret Kelly. I should have said, of course, but probably not a lot of people say this who serve or understand this or know this, served from 1984 to 1998. So it's fairly rare.
So, but there have been some examples, even in recent Missouri history. Aviva, what are the pros and cons here?
So the pros is that, you know, this would kind of add some uniformity and extend the same term limits in the governor and treasurer's office, and also would address kind of the issue of career politicians, which you sometimes hear a lot on the campaign trail. The cons are, you know, some people say, well, elections are really the term limits. If voters don't like what someone's doing in office, they can simply vote them out. And one of my colleagues at KCUR spoke with Republican Senator Ed Emery, and he kind of pointed to this broader idea that term limits can give lobbyists more power because you have a lawmaker. He was talking about lawmakers. He's, you know, you have a lawmaker who's in office, who's new. They might be more susceptible to influence from a lobbyist because they're brand new on the job and maybe they're still learning the ropes.
I was going to say, Aviva, the argument is this loss of institutional knowledge. We just saw the death in Missouri of longtime state Senator Wayne Good from the St. Louis area. I mean, that guy understood state government in a way that many of us who've been following it for years can only dream of. And when he was forced out, a lot of folks thought that's a real loss for the state of Missouri.
Yeah. What Ed Emery said, you know, he kind of relayed this conversation he had with the lobbyists, and he said, you know, before term limits, a state lawmaker would have never asked a lobbyist a question because a state lawmaker would have just kind of known the issue inside and out. But now lawmakers are asking, you know, lobbyist questions. This was just one example that the senator gave, but I thought it was kind of insightful.
Is there any organized opposition to this thing, Aviva?
Not that I can tell. There haven't been any groups that have registered with the Missouri Ethics Commission, you know, where they would be spending money on ads to try and sway voters.
So let me ask you a question that's going to be important, especially for Amendment 3, which involves the ethics thing. So on this term limits amendment, a yes vote means what and a no vote means what?
So if you're voting yes, you're voting for term limits for lieutenant governor, secretary of state, auditor, attorney general. No means you're not voting for those term limits.
Okay, then let's switch over to Amendment 3 here. This one may be more controversial because Republicans and Democrats appear to be split on it. Aviva, what does Amendment 3 do?
So it would ban gifts from paid lobbyists to legislators. Right now, the limit is $5, so that it would change it to zero. It would reduce campaign contribution limits by about $100 for state senators. But really, the big thing would be changes in the redistricting process. You may remember that in 2018, voters approved changes in redistricting process and how districts are drawn. And this would significantly alter what voters approved.
Hmm. Robin Kuhlman, why are Democrats and Republicans split over Amendment 3?
I would have to say that Amendment 3 is a split between, because it's you know, there are some possible problems that can occur if Amendment 3 does not pass. Or if Amendment 3 does pass, of course, the I would have to say the dream of, you know, not having a competitive election, some sort of change in state government would essentially dwindle away. I mean, I know that that was a mouthful. There's a lot to talk about in terms of Amendment 3, but there are a lot of probabilities of changes Amendment 3 can incur to lawmaking, to our election system, but also for representation. And of course, the way our districts look.
Robin, Aviva was just saying this Amendment 3 covers several issues, including a ban on gifts. It lowers the campaign donation limit. But at the end of the day, does this fight over Amendment 3 really come down to the whole redistricting idea?
I would have to say that it does. There are some lawmakers that are highly concerned. I would have to, be rightly concerned about the possibility of losing their seats because of the redistricting process, which essentially really would not occur otherwise if Amendment 3 does not pass. But there are also other concerns about dilution of minority votes, depending on how these districts are created. It's an interesting problem to have, and it's an interesting. In 2018, Clean Missouri was incredibly interesting to have. As a political scientist, to watch this occur, because a very unique system emerged out of this. Now, going back to, say, the bipartisan plan that we had, there essentially won't be any changes. But the biggest issue I see in terms of having a lot of opposition to this would be the possibility of losing seats as an elected representative, and also the possibility of dilution of minority representatives in office.
You know, this Clean Missouri idea passed in 2018, almost from the moment the polls closed that year. Republicans began advocating for changing Clean Missouri. Some Republicans said that voters didn't really know what they were voting on that year. Do you have any sense? Is there any truth to that?
I would have to say that in 2018, the ballot initiative was pretty clear as to what it was going to do. However, in terms of how exactly these districts were going to be redistricted after the 2020 census, probably is just a little bit more sophisticated than what, say, the average voter may understand. However, but I do want to point out that the fair ballot language was very clear in 2018.
Mm-hmm. You know, Aviva, it still strikes me as going without saying that Amendment 3 is a mouthful for voters to wrap their collective arms around. There's a lot to sort of navigate here and try to understand.
Yeah, especially when it comes to how districts are drawn. As Robin kind of alluded to, the 2018 amendment had kind of a math formula, essentially, to add partisan fairness and competitiveness as criteria for how districts are drawn, and that's really kind of new, and that would, could really change what districts look like. An AP analysis found that could add the number of seats the Democrats have. It wouldn't give them a majority. But what this current amendment would do is it would emphasize districts that are compact and contiguous, keeping kind of communities together.
This is the way the law is today, or what the law would be changed to?
Yeah, so the change that voters would vote on is emphasizing districts that are compact and contiguous. Mm-hmm. It still includes a part about partisan fairness and competitiveness, but that is not like the main criteria that is used, if that makes sense. There's like a list of criteria, and that's toward the bottom of the list.
Would Amendment 3 give redistricting control back to lawmakers, Aviva?
So there would be that commission that would draw the districts. It is interesting because if the commission is deadlocked, then that power actually would go to judges. Sometimes the commission is deadlocked, and it isn't actually the commission that ends up drawing the district boundaries.
Aviva, I want to be really clear here, because under the proposal, under Amendment 3, a governor-appointed bipartisan commission draws the district lines. That isn't all that different than the way it's been done in Missouri going back a number of decades.
You are correct. And part of the issue is, you know, we haven't seen what a state demographer would do, right?
This is the way the Clean Missouri proposal that's now in effect would have the lines drawn. There'd be a state auditor appointed by the a state demographer appointed by the state auditor who would draw these lines.
Yeah, right. And the demographer is appointed by the Senate majority and minority leader. The auditor takes the applications and then sends it to them. They make the decision.
Okay.
But yeah, a lot to work out. But yeah, essentially, districts are drawn up for the census. So, you know, we don't know the full effect of what, like, the state demographer drawing the districts are, because that hasn't happened yet.
And so we're going to go through this a couple times here, but a yes vote, Aviva, says what, and a no vote here does what?
So a yes vote changes how voters wanted changes to redistricting happened in 2018. So it undoes part of what voters supported in 2018. And then it also bans lobbyist gifts and makes a small change to contribution limits.
Do we have any sense, Robin, as to where Missourians stand on this question? I mean, Clean Missouri passed fairly easily. Have you seen any polls that suggest where we are here?
Unfortunately, I haven't. And Missouri right now, I mean, is really, really difficult to get any sort of public polling on these types of things. I would suspect that a lot of individuals are probably taking partisan cues from this, where Republicans have been the loudest supporters of Amendment 3. You're probably going to see a lot of Republicans support Amendment 3 and vice versa for Democrats.
The gift ban, Aviva, I think you mentioned that it's now $5. This proposed amendment would get rid of the gift ban altogether. How significant is that?
So the argument is, you know, this further reduces the influence of lobbyists. But, you know, others say, look, the limit is already $5, you know, so this isn't a huge change.
Yeah. What about the reduction in campaign donation limits, Aviva? Can you explain what that does?
Yeah. So right now it's at $2,500 for state senators, and it would reduce it by $100. So now the limit, if this passed, would be $2,400.
Okay, so again, I'm not seeing that this proposed amendment does much in a significant way to either campaign donation limits or the gift ban. That leaves the redistricting thing as really sort of the main focus here, if I'm seeing this right.
Yeah, it's small changes to contribution limits and lobbyist gifts.
Okay. Robin, again, how big a deal is all this? What's your perspective on this idea of this redistricting idea and how significant it is?
I think it's a very significant issue. You know, a lot of voters are concerned about partisan gerrymandering in the state of Missouri. Although, you know, if you look at partisan gerrymandering and some of the measures that measure partisan gerrymandering in the state of Missouri, it's actually fairly minimal. However, one problem that we have in the state is we have a lot of non-competitive or uncompetitive districts. We have a lot of uncontested elections. Over the past 10 years, 95% of Missouri House seats were uncompetitive. That means that essentially nobody passed the 5% margin threshold when trying to run against a candidate. As for uncontested elections, it's 41%. And I think this is incredibly important. Contested elections and competitive elections at the base level is important in terms of having some sort of check on government. Because if representatives have no pull from the electorate, then it gives them a little bit more freedom to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. you know, without any sort of consequence. And so I think that's the crux of, you know, what Amendment 1 was about in 2018. The ramifications of uncompetitive elections is, again, is having citizens having the control over accepting or rejecting representatives.
Right.
And if Amendment 3 does not pass, there may be more control over that process.
Let me go to a phone call here to Elias from Kansas City, Missouri. Elias, good morning.
Hi there. I know you guys don't have much time. So this issue actually managed to garner the interest of even The Economist, which is a British periodical. The article is Skullduggery in Missouri. And I think we're underplaying at least the added rules to the redistricting process that would occur as a result of passing yes on Proposition 3, which would include not counting basically people who are not registered to vote, which also translates to those who are younger than 18 years old, which coincidentally means that about 50% of Latinos in this entire state no longer get represented in terms of the districting process. This obviously passes on to other minority populations, but in terms of Missouri, it's particularly perverse, mind my language, for those who are Latino. And so I think we're, at least from the coverage thus far, this aspect of it seems to have been downplayed or not acknowledged enough, in my opinion,
right,
because it does effectively influence who is seen and not seen in that districting process in a very literal way.
I appreciate the phone call, Elias. Thank you. Robin, Aviva, any thought, comment on that?
Yeah, I have a thought on that. I think it's a very legitimate concern. The Supreme Court has, in terms of counting populations, kind of left it open as to who states can include in terms of the redistricting process. So I would assume that if Amendment 3 does not pass and we go back to 2008, Amendment 1, and that does occur in terms of counting populations, there could be some significant lawsuits that we would see.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Robin Kuhlman from the University of Central Missouri. We are also joined by Aviva Okeson-Haberman. She's KCUR's Missouri government reporter. Thank you both for good conversation. Much appreciated.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
Sidelined from his usual job as a reviewer of live music shows in Kansas City, Bill Brownlee turned from jazz, blues, rock and roll, and pop to a genre he's never covered before, and that's opera. What led to his decision to listen to an opera a day for the last 200 days? He'll be completing his odyssey today. And how has it changed him? In a recent blog post, Bill was very direct. He wrote this, "My daily opera initiative during the pandemic altered my worldview." Here's betting that some members of our audience have taken on some interesting arts or cultural projects during this strange time we're all living through. We'd like to hear from them at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Back with us again, KCUR music contributor Bill Brownlee. Bill, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Where did this idea come from to listen to an opera a day, Bill?
Well, Steve, like everyone else, I suddenly had a lot of free time on my hands. And the last concert I attended was March 7th, Luciana Souza at the Folly Theater, the great Brazilian artist.
Right.
And 10 days into, you know, about 10 days after that, I thought, man, I've got to come up with something to replace all the concerts I've been going to for the last 30 years. I realized the Metropolitan Opera was streaming for no charge, a different opera every night. And that's where I began.
Did you do this out of a sense of obligation or a sense of adventure, Bill? What drove it?
Well, I've always been motivated, Steve, by the thrill of discovery. I'd rather hear something for the first time than revisit an old favorite for the 100th time. And I realized opera was my blind spot. I grew up on country music. And as you said in the introduction, I have covered popular music for a long time, but I really didn't know that much about opera. I attended less than 10 operas in my lifetime. And I thought, I want to, you know, take care of this. I want to figure out what I've been missing. And I'm not going to lie. You know, the first 10 or 20 operas I watched, man, that was rough sledding. You know, I didn't understand what was happening. I couldn't acclimate to the tone or the that crazy singing style. But about, 25 or 30 in, I started to get there. And I realized that, I began to appreciate everything I was seeing and hearing. And, it didn't hurt that, learning that opera is all about, love, lust, body counts and alcohol.
You write on your blog, "There Stands the Glass," that my prior obliviousness of these essential works shames me, referring to these operas that you listen to. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's only, you don't know what you don't know until, the veil is lifted from your eyes. And in seeing works like Wagner's Ring Cycle or Mozart's The Magic Flute, I realized that a lot of popular music, whether knowingly or unknowingly, is based on not only the themes, but, the librettos and the music of these great works. And beyond that, and things like The Magic Flute, it's the opera, Mozart's opera is about the levers of power that operate behind the scenes. In fact, I frequently joke that, I didn't know the Illuminati was real until I saw The Magic Flute. So only now do I feel like I've become a proper adult, having undergone this process.
What is it about music? I've noticed this myself so many times over the years, that the first time you hear a piece of music, it may do nothing for you, but then the fourth or fifth time, it suddenly lights you up in a way that's really remarkable. And you're saying that you had the same experience with opera, that the first five or seven you listened to, tough sledding, to use your words, but then the light went off.
Yeah, it's just a matter of, becoming acclimated to the sound. I mean, opera is, it doesn't have that immediate payoff. Last night I watched Wagner's Tristan und Isolde for the second time, second production. And I saw my first one in the early stages, and, seeing these enormous vocalists, stand and deliver on stage in German, it just didn't work for me. And getting through 4 hours of that was tough. But last night, all 4 hours of this production just moved me profoundly. When the vocalist playing Tristan, I think it's Stuart Skelton, sang about the vast realm of divine oblivion, I had a lump in my throat. All of a sudden I can relate. It's just a matter of, understanding that in opera, there's not going to be an immediate payoff as there is in popular music.
Did you, besides listening, Bill, did you spend a lot of time reading about each individual opera that you were about to approach? And did that help?
Oh, for certain. The Metropolitan Opera, which is just one of the resources I've turned to, they, provide a printed, digital PDF of their programs. So I refer to those. I check books out from the library. Yeah, so I was trying to understand, what I was seeing and what I was hearing, and then through the process, I started to, learn, who my favorite composers were, who my favorite vocalists were, my favorite opera houses, and so on. So, as with anything else, it gets easier. It's like riding a bike.
You're going to listen to your 200th opera today. What is it going to be?
I haven't decided, Steve. The Metropolitan Opera is having Wagner Week, and tonight it's Tannhäuser, which I've seen twice already, different productions. This would be a third production. I may go with that, but I also have a stack of DVDs from the library that I might turn to. So I don't know. And that's part of the fun. It depends on how I feel at, say, 6 o'clock tonight.
So it sounds like your interest in opera, you will have accomplished your goal of 200 operas in 200 days, but this is going to continue. You're going to listen to opera going forward.
Yeah, I'm not going to drop it. At some point, I feel like I should give myself a break. And my family is suffering mightily every time I every time I crank up the system.
Well, let's help our audience get initiated to the world of opera here. Let's listen to a little bit of the Magic Flute. This is Mozart. That's the Berlin Philharmonic's performance of the Magic Flute. On your blog post the other day, you mentioned Einstein on the Beach, Bill. This was the 189th opera that you listened to. Of it, you wrote that your willful surrender to all 5 hours of Philip Glass's 1976 work transmuted me into a state of enlightened acquiescence. Explain that to me.
Yeah, well, it's kind of Einstein on the Beach is the opposite of the Magic Flute. You know, we're listening to the pa 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 song from Mozart now, and that's the two characters have been introduced, and they're singing right now in this Mozart piece about all the fun they're going to have making babies. So, you know, it's kind of a filthy song actually, but with Philip Glass, it's just the opposite of that. It's Einstein on the Beach is really about nothing. It's about infinity. And, you know, with his minimalism, it's 5 hours of, repetition and slow change. And with pretty images on the stage, but no storyline. So one has to give him or herself over to that just state of nothingness and just let the music carry him or herself away, because there's nothing happening. And through that nothingness, it's like meditation or maybe yoga, you can achieve some kind of transcendent state. I loved Einstein on the Beach, but Glass's Akhenaten is even better for trying to float on the ceiling. Philip Glass's music will get you there.
Why 200 operas in 200 days? Why not 100 or 500?
It could be 500.
Or not. It's, if your family has anything to say about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I might have to get a little studio apartment somewhere if I choose that course. No, it's just a crash course. And as we touched on earlier, it's only now do I feel like I'm starting to move beyond the, wide-eyed newbie stage to understand what I'm hearing and seeing. But 200 is a pretty good number. And of those, I'd say 125 were unique experiences, and then the other 74 have been things I've different productions of things I've taken in previously.
You know, some folks might be thinking if this is what it takes to get into opera, you know, 200 operas in 200 days, lots of reading, lots of immersion into it, and the payoff is what you're describing it, you know, maybe it's not worth it.
I mean, it's not easy. I'm not going to lie. But here's the thing. The reason I hadn't, you know, done that much opera previously is ticket prices are really prohibitive. It's tough. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, the opera house in town might object to that, but I've never not sat in the back two or three rows here in Kansas City. And last year I went to the Metropolitan Opera in New York for the first time. I sat in the back row because that's, you know, that's $50 a pop for the back row. So you can imagine what the, you know, the front row would right. be. But you know, I can watch these operas, Steve, in my sweatpants and a t-shirt, you know, not in a tuxedo or not wearing, you know, a pearl necklace. And it really is accessible. And as I said, like that, the Papageno song we just heard, it's, you know, there's nothing challenging about that. It's just like the Ramones with violins.
Well, listeners can hear the Royal Opera House Saturdays at noon on Classical KC 91.9. They can also go to classicalkc.org. So who were some of the stars who emerged to you during the course of your listening? And what about the work of one of our own native daughters, Joyce DiDonato from Prairie Village?
Her turn in the Italian version of Cinderella is fantastic. She's very funny. And in fact, that's probably a pretty good entry point for someone, you know, looking to get into opera. She's also been in one or two productions, I believe, of Hansel and Gretel. You know, it's even though it's for children, it's very good. The music is fantastic. But yeah, there are new stars from Joyce to Eric Owens, who is one of Joyce's friends, Danielle Denise. There's a new vocalist from Scandinavia called Lisa Davidson, who is going to be a fantastic star. Yeah, I've watched old and new operas, Steve, and you know, back in the 60s and 70s.
I got about 10 more seconds, Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, well, today's opera singers are young and athletic and very different from the stereotypical opera singers.
Well, that's Bill Brownlee. He survived 200 operas in 200 days and lived to write about it on There Stands the Glass, his blog post. He also writes about jazz at Plastic Sax. Bill, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Steve. That was fun.
I'm Steve Kraske. You've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll see you tomorrow.